Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo episode 128. I am once again your host, Jonathan Metz, back from vacation, and we've got the whole crew with us here. James Jones. James is not feeling up to snuff today, I'm afraid. But he's quite a trucker to have shown up at all, so we appreciate that. John Lindemann.
Hey.
He here in his usual mode. And Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy.
The only Englishman on the site this week.
The only one that matters.
On the site?
On the podcast, I should say.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Glad to have you guys here. My brain's not quite here. And by the way, this will be fun for our listeners to listen out for my southern accent coming in and out, because I've been around southern people, namely my family, for 3 weeks, and quite a bit of it infused back into me, and it'll probably take a while before it, you know, seeps back out, hanging around people out here out west and talking to you guys. So you may even notice a difference between the beginning of the show and the end of the show. It wouldn't surprise me, because as I get into like deep conversation with these guys...
Dan, you went home recently too, didn't you?
Yeah.
Are you going to give us some wonderful Canadian?
A little Canuck?
Canuck? No, I mean, mostly what I did there is just swear at all the snow that kept falling and falling and falling.
God, well, Canadians swear a lot.
How dare you go beyond the current borders of the United States and deal with snow?
I agree. How dare I? I'm not going to do that anymore.
Well, anyway, I'm back from Alabama, and honestly didn't do a lot of gaming there. I didn't take my Wii. My sister and her husband have one, so I got to play theirs a little bit. I played a fair bit of DS, but it was a lot of old stuff. Not very interesting. But anyway, before we jump into new business, I do have one or two things to talk about, and maybe these guys do too. But before we jump into new business, I just want to say I really appreciate them keeping the show afloat when I'm gone. In fact, I think... I mean, in some ways, they were better than the shows that I am on, or maybe I just have more fun listening to them since it's all a surprise for me. But I think you guys did a really nice job, and it was a lot of fun hearing them. And I also just really quickly want to wish all of our listeners a happy new year. It'll be after the beginning of the it'll have to be after January 1st by the time you hear this. And so, happy new year for everyone who's not Chinese. But you know what, actually, Happy New Year to the Chinese, too. They just get a two-for-one. They just get to celebrate twice, you know? So we'll start off with new business today, and we'll get into your listener mail after the break. But for new business, I figured I would go first. I've been gone the longest here. And really, two games that I'll bring up. I played entirely through Chrono Trigger. I was reviewing it, and... my first time through the game, I put in 35 hours, which is actually a lot more than you need to beat it. In fact, you can beat Chrono Trigger in about 16 hours, probably, if you really fly through it. That's if you know where to go and you kind of know all the strategies for all the bosses and everything. There's a ton of optional content stacked at the end of the game. And... you know, a lot of that it takes a while, and for the DS version, they added a couple new things. There's a place called the Lost Sanctum, which is kind of it's like a bunch of fetch quests, basically. I mean, it has some new areas to fight through, but the enemies are all the same from, you know, they're just collected from different parts of the game. And the art assets are all being recycled. It ends up being not a very interesting addition of content, unfortunately. I mean, it definitely adds several hours to the game. I would say 3 or 4 hours at least to go through it all. But it's just because you have to fight a bunch of battles just over and over again. You keep, you know, treading back and forth over parts of the map. And the rewards that you get really aren't that great. They're mostly like just money, which is silly because anyone at the end of the game is going to run out of things to spend money on, because the shops, you know, most of the good stuff doesn't come from shops by the end of the game. So you never really need money that much through the whole game. Money is kind of just an afterthought. And so for them to put on all this extra content for people who really have already mastered the game in some form and they want to play something extra, and for the reward to be money, is kind of just a kick in the face. But there is another piece of content they added called Dimensional Vortex, and there are three of them in various time periods. And those are actually a lot more interesting. Put them all together, they're not as long as the Lost Sanctum, but the Dimensional Vortices have more like original thought put into them. They're still reusing art assets, but they kind of create these little mini dungeons or mini areas that look like places you've been to before, but they're different. They have different puzzles, and they even have some new enemies, and they have treasure chests with some really good equipment that's actually better than equipment you could have gotten before. So they like kind of created new items. They put some more thought into this. And then you fight these little bosses at the end, and you get some status boost for your characters. So, I mean, the reward isn't super awesome, but it's better than some gold that you'll never use. And so those parts are actually worth doing. And then there's a secret boss that that totally kicked my ass. And I was already really, really, really powerful, like way overpowered. I mean, I killed the final boss easily. So the super secret ultra boss is much, much more difficult. I have no idea what happens when you beat it. I haven't checked. But I mean, that's Chrono Trigger. And
now I had a question about it, Johnny. I had a question about the endings, because how many different endings are there?
70,000.
I believe there were 14 in the original version, and they added one more for the DS.
Now, how does that work? Like, how does the kind of branching work? Do you make a choice early in the game or really late in the game?
Okay, so the first time that you play through the game, mm-hmm. there are really only maybe two or three different endings that you might get. And it depends on how you approach the final boss, mm-hmm. because the game just lays out, I mean, it's not a secret, the game gives you two or three different ways to get to the final boss, mm-hmm. and they're all slightly different, and the boss battle will be slightly different, and the ending will then be slightly different as well. There's also, I don't want to spoil it for anyone who's playing it for the first time, but there is something that happens to the main character, and whether you address that or not in one of the side quests at the end of the game makes a huge difference in the ending that you get.
Okay.
But other than that, that maybe accounts for four or five of them. And then all the rest of them are really weird little endings. A lot of them are kind of funny or just very quirky. And those are generally found in the New Game Plus mode, which is what you play through after you've already beaten the game once. What it lets you restart the story, but you keep all of your levels and equipment mm-hmm. and magic. So the game's really easy the second time through, but there are a few things you can do that you couldn't do the first time that will give you a challenge the mm-hmm. second time through. And it gives you the opportunity to do things differently, since there are a couple of little branching paths. I mean, it is a Japanese RPG. It's mostly very linear, but there are a couple of pretty major choices you get to make. And there's some small choices, too. Sometimes you go to a place, and it's like, choose which treasure chest you want. You know, you pick one, the other disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So the second time through, you can get the other one. Now you have the stuff from both, because you've been through the game twice, and you get to keep your stuff each
yeah.
time. So all the other endings basically depend on when you approach and defeat the final boss the second time through. And
okay.
it's actually possible to, on your second time through, it's possible to go fight the final boss within 5 minutes of the start of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's challenging, but you get a very cool ending if you do, where you get to talk to a bunch of the developers and they give you little comments. So
that's pretty cool. Yep.
Yeah, it's really neat. It's a fun little Easter egg, and Chrono Trigger is just full of Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I actually met a guy on the bus yesterday who was playing his DS. I said, "Oh, hey, what are you playing over there?" He said, "Chrono Trigger." I said, "Awesome. That's like my favorite game of all time." And I had my own copy in my backpack, but I wasn't playing it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to really liking it. He said it was his first time. I said, "Hey, you're lucky." And I tell anybody, you know, if you've never played this game before, now you have the chance to, and I really almost envy you for getting the chance to experience it in that fresh sense, because for me it's very nostalgic, but it's also kind of cursory to play through Chrono Trigger, because I played it so many times as a kid.
Yeah, see, I've never
and
played it.
It's just hitting
it.
The notes, you know,
mm-hmm.
for me. I mean,
yeah.
it's very pleasurable, but I know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because I just know that game inside and out. And it's such a beautiful experience. It's so great that I really do sort of envy anyone who's playing it for the first time.
On that note, you'd say it is as sort of excellent a recreation as we were led to believe it would be before it was released?
It's not even really a recreation. I mean, it is a port. It is a virtual console level port. And they shoehorned in a couple of things, the things I talked about towards the end.
Yeah.
But it's portable. And they're, I don't know that portable is worth paying $40 for it, but again, basically a used copy of Chrono Trigger will cost you a lot more than the MSRP of the DS Chrono Trigger. So I can't complain that much about the whole Square Tax thing, because even though it's a little overpriced maybe for a 12-year-old game, 13-year-old game, it's still cheaper to buy the new brand new DS version than it is to go out and find an old Super Nintendo cartridge.
Yeah, all those Square Enix games considering are...
considering how much that game cost when it came out for the Super Nintendo, it can't be surprising.
Yeah,
I think I paid $90 for it.
Yeah, in Canada, I remember it being, I think
new.
It was...
That was, like, brand new.
Yeah,
when it
new,
first came out.
In Canada, it was like $120 or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but that's Canadian fun money. That doesn't
matter. Didn't see that coming, did you,
13%
John?
Tax on that. On top of that. So it was ridiculous. It was almost like $150.
I know. But Chrono Trigger is probably worth it.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, looking back,
I don't think too many people who bought it back then were upset with it. I mean, it's always nice if you can get the same thing for less money. But Chrono Trigger is one of the few games that I think is worth paying a lot of money if you have to. I used to tell people all the time, if you see it at a GameStop for $60, buy it. It's worth it.
Yeah.
Even 10 years later, it's worth it. It's awesome. And it's one of the very few RPGs that you can play through more than one time. And it gives you reasons to do that. And it's a fairly easy game, and it's also pretty short for an RPG. Like I said, you can blow through it in 15, 20 hours. So the prospect of playing through it, say, three times in a row is really not that daunting, whereas Final Fantasy VI, you might take you 60 hours the first time. So, I think you do get a lot out of it for an RPG, and there's so many different things to do in it, and you're not going to get to do them all the first time you go through it. So anyway, the one other game, I didn't mean for this to take so long, but the one other game I did play a fair bit of was something I had from Gamefly that I took home with me and played on my sister's Wii, and that's Resident Evil Umbrella Chronicles.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't have a zapper.
Oh, wow.
Really,
because it doesn't, yeah. It doesn't count now. I'm afraid your opinion is irrelevant.
Right.
You didn't play the game the way it was intended. I don't want to hear what you have to say about
right.
it.
This is like one of us trying to review a Mystery Dungeon game now.
No, I actually really liked it. I didn't get to play all the way through it before I decided to just go ahead and send it back. But
Did you not have an hour?
No. Have you played this, James?
How long is it?
It's actually like 10 hours long. That's one thing I really liked about it. It has to be the longest light gun game I've ever seen.
Yeah, that
seen.
Would be very long, but I suppose it isn't sort of... It wasn't designed for the arcade, so...
Exactly. It's not an arcade port, and that's very rare to get a light gun game that didn't originate in the arcade. So this is a game that was made specifically for Wii, and what impresses me about it is that they added a lot of stuff. I mean, obviously the Wii is well-suited for light gun games, but they also added a lot of stuff that's really... could only work well on the Wii. I mean, you have actually a surprisingly good slashing mechanic with your knife that is indispensable. And it's free, and you can do it in all kinds of different directions. The motion controls recognize different directions that you're doing it. And it's like, there really isn't a good way to do that in an arcade game. And then the length is a huge factor, I think. I mean, this game is designed to sit down and play it for an hour or two. And you're not going to finish it in that time. You might finish a couple levels. So I was really impressed at the amount of content. And not only are there... I mean, because, it spans like four Resident Evil games. And it's definitely summarizing all of them. It's like the Reader's Digest condensed book version of Resident Evil 1, 2, 3, and Code Veronica, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And but, the story... I'm not sure that the story would make sense if you haven't played those games, but it does hit all the notes and kind of remind you of what happened in them. And you definitely do get a lot of the key scenes that were memorable from when you played those games. So it kind of cuts out all the, all the flab and just boils these games down into the most interesting parts. And it's really fun, actually. It's really good. And the great thing, because they cover so much territory across those four games, Umbrella Chronicles ends up being pretty lengthy. And not only do you get three levels per game, but you also get all these little side missions that you play, where you play as Wesker or you play as Rebecca. You play as these different characters who are involved in the stories, but they weren't the main characters of those games. And their little side missions are actually pretty long in and of themselves, and you get to collect some weapons that you can't get otherwise, and then you can use in all the missions. And even though they do retread some of the same areas, sometimes there'll be a lot of differences when they go through there, and then sometimes they have exclusive areas that you only find in their side missions. I mean, I played a mission with Wesker where I fought a totally different boss. So it, mm-hmm. that's not just like thrown together, you know, throwaway content. So, I guess overall, the main thing that impressed me about it was just that it is freaking huge for a light game.
It's 1 through 3 in Code Veronica, right?
I believe so, yeah. I only played through Resident Evil 2 on it, so I played maybe half of the game, although I didn't play all the side missions.
You know why they picked those three, right? Because if they put the fourth game in there, despite being thematically incompatible, one of the mini levels would have to be, don't shoot Ashley in the face. Resist the urge to shoot her in the face while she keeps screaming Leon at you.
I liked Ashley.
I would get to about 18 seconds.
She was so useless, that's why I hated her.
No, she wasn't useless. She was actually negatively useful.
All right, well, one thing I did want to note about it, though, as I was playing this, one of the podcasts I took home with me was an episode of 1UP FM where they interviewed the guys who are making, they're actually at Kuju or whatever they changed their name to.
Yeah, they're Headstrong Games, they call themselves
Headstrong,
these days. But,
that's right. And they're making House of the Dead Overkill, which is for Sega, which is coming out in early 2009. And they asked them they were obviously kind of fishing for comparisons to Umbrella Chronicles.
That's a whole different game altogether.
You know, the interviewers were fishing for those comparisons because I think they wanted to know things like, is it going to be as long? Is it going to use some specific Wii features? And the House of the Dead Overkill guys, I mean, it sounds like a really interesting game. I like the whole grindhouse art style they're doing with it. But I think they said it was going to be like 2 or 3 hours long.
Yeah, that's what I recall from that interview. So they're going for like the what I assume is the standard House of the Dead length, based on the arcade game.
I think they're really – that's a big missed opportunity because Umbrella Chronicles, the reason it works as a console game, it's not like Ghost Squad where it's 30 minutes long and you just play through it over and over.
And terrible.
And there are little differences. You know, I mean, Resident Evil Umbrella Chronicles is a full-length game. Full-length console game. And I think that's why I would recommend it to people. That's the primary reason I would say. You know, light gun games on consoles, they're fun sometimes, but you really don't get much for your money. This is the one where you do. And you would think a year later, actually more than a year later, the House of the Dead guys would take a cue from that. And instead, they're going back to the arcade format where it's really pretty short. And maybe there's a bonus mode, a director's cut, where you play through it again.
Because their position is kind of like a side story with this all overkill thing and the different art style and stuff, you could think it would be fine to have it be different. You know, if it was called House of the Dead 5, it'd be more obvious that it would be just like the other four.
Yeah, but it's probably less about story, more about action.
It's really action-y.
Well, I'm sure it's non-stop and sort of over the top, but, you know, it just seems like, considering it's, you know, strictly for console and all that, and it's got this different moniker, why not? It could have been different, but I don't know, maybe that was just too ambitious or something. They just needed to get it out. You know, that's not what Sega wanted.
Sega were willing to pay for. I mean, I have to say, after playing Umbrella Chronicles, I do really want to play Overkill. I want to see how they compare, and it has me more excited to play Overkill. But hearing what they said about the length, that's a big disappointment for me, and it's going to sort of bias me against it even before I play it, because I'm thinking, you know, this is going to be really short. And I don't know, I hope it's very dense. I guess that's what I should say.
And like you said, it'll have to be replayable. It'll have to have those kinds of little things in there that means you can get something extra out of subsequent playthroughs and have a kind of high score kind of thing to manipulate very well, because otherwise you're just not going to... If it's pretty much 3 hours and there's not that much incentive to replay, then that's pretty weak for what would presumably be a fairly expensive game.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, anyway, that's all my new business. Sorry for taking so long. James, do you have anything?
Yeah, I'm going to try to keep it short, but I got the new Prince of Persia game, which I believe is just called The Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
In a way, I'm happy with it. In a way, I feel... I mean, I beat it in 3 sittings. It's really short.
Right.
And in a way, I'm happy with it, and in a way, I'm kind of disappointed. I feel like, in some respects, it went back to what I originally loved about The Sands of Time. Mm-hmm. And then in some respects, it just completely... abandoned all of that. And you know, a good example is the new prince, as they refer to him, is he's not as witty as the original prince. He's much more, you know, crude humor and stuff. And he has, well, to be honest, he's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed American, essentially. And he talks like it with all these cultural anachronisms, despite the fact that nobody around him has the same sort of weirdness to him. I don't know, it just sort of felt like it took me out of the game a little bit, because part of what I liked was, you know, the refined banter between the two characters in The Sands of Time. Mm-hmm. They did get the banter, get, you know, that sort of dialogue back, in part because your female lead is with you the entire time. There is not a minute where she's not on the screen with you. So there is constant communication between the two, which is better than the second game, which is an abomination. The Warrior Within.
The third one's pretty good.
The third one's pretty good about that. It never got quite up to the writing level of the first game, which I think might be one of the best written dialogue games of all time.
Yeah. The third one is good.
Just constantly good dialogue. I enjoyed the game, but in the art style is really nice, except for the fact there's this whole light and dark mechanic in the game, and sort of the whole story is driven by it. And as you purify areas from darkness, the color returns to them. So up until that point, they're just grays and blacks and some reds. And with such a dark color palette, it's very, very difficult to see a lot of the jumps right, or see the hazards as you're doing like a wall run. So a lot of times you're basically jumping blindly because there's not enough color in the palette to differentiate things. It's just too dark. And you could conceivably go and turn the gamma up on your TV or in the game, then it's not going to display right for everything else. It's not dark, if that makes sense. So the color palette choices actually become their own obstacle. Which is a shame, because...
But the game's super easy, though, isn't it? That's what everybody says.
It is really easy, because unlike in the Sands games, so all the games that use The Sands of Time, that's not there anymore. And when you screw up a jump, the princess in this game basically uses magic to materialize, grab your hand, and throw you back to the last platform you were standing on. So you can never die. I never died in this game, not even in fights.
Yeah.
Because the fighting doesn't use health mechanic. It uses sort of like a... I think Call of Duty is a good example, where the screen becomes red from the outside as you take damage, and you slowly heal.
Of War does that too.
Yeah, and I don't think I ever was in any mortal danger for health. It is really easy, but
that's
it's
weird,
kind of...
Because the other ones are so hard.
They are.
Very trial and error. Sands of Time is essentially an answer to the trial and error nature of it, you know.
Yeah.
But it's limited.
There is some trial and error in the combat, because there are like different modes your opponents are in and how you can get them actually do damage to them, and it does take a while to get that down. So a lot of times you'll just be flailing at this opponent for 20 minutes until you finally realize, okay, I can do this specific attack and then I can hurt them. And it does get a little old in that regard, but once you play it enough, you get used to that. But the real issue is that there are some things that just don't feel like they worked quite right. And, you know, the cheap falls from some of the jumps was a big one, because there might be a series of jumps. There was one series of jumps that I timed at 4 minutes long. So if you screwed that up, you went all the way back to the beginning. At least with the Sands, you could back yourself up to like when you were hanging on a wall or something.
Right.
This takes you all the way back to the last platform you were on. Well, if you can't see the jumps very well, you have to memorize them. But if it's that long, it's a lot to memorize. So it does get very, very tedious in that a lot of times. But like overall, the game's quite good. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, clever. I mean, there's only so much you can do with run jump puzzles. But there, you know, it's a nice world to go through. It's majority outside, so there's lots of big open areas, and there were some of those in the original games, but it was mostly confined to chambers. So there's a lot of open space you're running through, and you know, climbing up really high, and it does have a certain feel of Assassin's Creed to it, which makes sense given the development team. But it almost feels like it took a step back in terms of climbing from Assassin's Creed, because in Assassin's Creed they wanted you to be able to go everywhere you could. Mm-hmm. But in this game, they don't want you to, because it is somewhat more linear. They don't want you to be able to climb to the top of anything you see. So it does feel a bit more confining in that respect, and which is kind of upsetting, because I was hoping it would be like the Prince of Persia with that mechanic in it. But that's really just an expectations thing.
All right, so anything else?
Not really.
All right, that's cool. John, what you got, man?
Well, the one interesting little Nintendo tidbit that I have is my mom, who is 72 years old, God bless her heart, she asked for a Nintendo DS for Christmas this year.
Wow.
Yeah, which pretty much...
Good for her.
Which was funny because...
I didn't buy it for her.
It came completely out of nowhere. She, I guess, you know, she's just been kind of bored and... You know, she's seen DS ads on TV. I wish I would have asked her what DS ads she's seen, but because I just would have been curious as to which ones would have appealed to her. But I think it was just kind of one of those things where she's like, yeah, I know that you have one. I know my sister has one. Hell, friggin' everybody in the world has one. But I think it's just one of those things where she was like, yeah, that looks like it could be kind of fun. And so I got her the holiday package which is really cool. For $150, you get like the ice blue one, the ice blue DS, Brain Age, and like a little like ice blue carrying case. That's actually pretty cool. It'd be perfect for like
it's
little.
A good deal.
Yeah, it's a really good deal. And I got. She also wanted a puzzle game called Zenses. You know.
The ocean and rainforest.
It's the game
and...
made for women. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep, so
yeah,
I got her that.
It's made specifically for what you should have gotten her Puzzle Quest.
Yeah,
Puzzle Quest is sort of very, like, male teenager focused in terms of the aesthetic, you know, it's all skulls and magicians and shit, but,
Well, I feel like it's almost like some sort of grand experiment. Like, I don't know what kind of game she's going to gravitate towards. I mean, I got her, like, you know, the puzzle ones, obviously, but... Sister, she the game that she always plays is Star Fox Command, and it's like, you know,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, she's my age, and I'm like, she loves that game, loves Star Fox Command. I never would have been able to pen that, so I'm gonna kind of poke her periodically just to see, you know, what kind of game she's interested in or like what she's seen on TV.
You should show her that personal trainer video. Have you guys seen this on the Nintendo channel where Fred Willard is making chili?
No, but Christ, that's pretty almighty. Genius.
It's really weird. It is really, really weird. Like, it doesn't have any kind of consistent tone to it. So sometimes it's obviously like very tongue in cheek, and then sometimes it's very earnest, like these like America Ferrera Nintendo DS commercials. So it has this crazy mixture, and Fred Willard, you know, he's a really funny guy, but then it has all these other people in it, and he talks about them as if the viewer should know who they are, but they just refer to them by their first names. And I've never seen any of them before. Like, maybe they're comedians, or maybe they're just his neighbors. I have no idea who these people are. And
he's
they all stand around and they make chili. And one of his friend, it's his friend's birthday, and they want to cook for her birthday. And she's vegetarian. So they make meat chili, but they make one batch of it vegetarian for her. And when they serve it at the table, Fred puts down the bowls and says, "Here's your vegetarian and here's mine." And then right before she eats it, he says, "Oops, I switched them." That's so tasteless to do that to someone. So it's 8 minutes long. It's just totally bizarre.
God, yeah. Why?
I watched the whole thing yesterday.
I felt sick before.
I was transfixed.
After hearing this, I feel like I'm going to go die in the corner.
I was transfixed. Anyway.
I just think it's great that they chose him. I mean, he's kind of...
I know. Fred Willard, he's got so much cred, you know.
Yeah, he's so niche. He's like, but you know, exactly. He has that underground cred.
Yeah. But, I mean, he's in Spinal Tap.
I know. He's in all kinds of crazy
movies. And by the way, the other weird thing is in the video they say damn. Mm-hmm. And I think he calls someone a son of a bitch. and they say beer. They say beer.
Oh, is there like a son of a bitch? Yeah, beer? Fuck.
No, they're talking about these different things you can put in chili, like different things to flavor it, and he mentions that you can put beer in it. And I just remembered back to that blog post where he said beer is the watchword. You know, they wouldn't let that one WiiWare game out because it was beer pong, and they had to change it to Pong Toss.
Well, that shows you who the intended audience of that clip is versus the intended audience that they think beer pong is trying to reach. But yeah, I think it really is interesting right now, kind of like what Nintendo is doing with their marketing, how they're marketing their products, who they're marketing it to, the effectiveness of that marketing. Because I don't know if I've ever seen like a video game company this successful being able to market across the spectrum as much as Nintendo can do right now. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody's really been able to say, yeah, okay, well, we don't really have to market to necessarily the gamer kind of thing. You know, we can just say, yeah, we're going to take somebody's, you know, we can take a 40-year-old father of two and market to him, or we can take a grandmother and market to them, and only market to them, actually target marketing to them.
I think the reason we've never seen anyone be successful is because no one's really ever tried. I mean, for God's sakes, look at the ad campaigns we dealt with until just now.
Yeah.
I think the first really super casual game ad I saw not targeted at me was something like, either it was for like a kid's game or it was something like SingStar.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think, you know, there's been a whole, nobody's ever really tried it like this.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, those are still kind of, they're still games though, you know? I mean,
SingStar is
like,
not a game. SingStar is not a game.
Well, I mean, it's still, there's still the aspect of play there, right? I mean, personal cooking trainer, it's, or something like that.
Right.
I mean, that's not a game at
you
all.
You know, actually, Fred Willard refers to it as a game in that video, and that kind of caught my ear.
Yeah.
I'm surprised Nintendo didn't kind of coach him beforehand and not call it that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a game. I mean, it's. I wouldn't even call it a non-game. It's like kind of like a tool or like a productivity
tool.
It's a tool.
Right.
Yeah. It's a book in DS form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, Greg, you're up last on new business.
Yep. Well, I've been enjoying the delights of the Japanese Wii. Lots of virtual console games, stuff like Gynorg, Axlay, Mega Man 2, all sorts of things. That's all been a lot of fun. But I also got Tatsunoko versus Capcom.
I was wondering if you were going to go for that.
Yeah, I got a decent deal on it. You know, it's still kind of expensive, but not that much more expensive than a retail game that costs over here. So, yeah, I went for it a little different. I haven't bought many non-Smash Brothers fighting games in the last 15 years. So.
But this is sort of
it's not that different. It's more towards Smash Brothers than most. The sort of traditional fighting games, but obviously it's still the basic concept that it's not about knocking people out of a stage or that sort. You know, it's actually about the health bar and sort of the way the moves are performed. Obviously, isn't as simple as Smash Brothers, but it's been so obviously it's based off the Versus games in the past, like Marvel vs. Capcom, and it's been somewhat simplified. As we've talked about before on the show, like there's just three buttons now rather than separate punches and kicks, and all the special moves are pretty simple to pull off. They're just like little, almost all quarter circles and like a few ones that are more sophisticated than that, so it's all pretty, and the supers are just like press two buttons at once and do pretty much the same kind of motion, so it's all pretty simple. But there is kind of more,
well, you say that's simple, but that's all more complicated than
Smash
Brothers.
Exactly, that's where, well, it's my original point that it is so different from Smash Bros.
Right.
But for that sort of thing it's been a little simplified and it doesn't go too far with it. And then where it's more complicated is just all the, like, you've got two characters, you can kind of manage their health bars a bit in the sense that, you know, like some of their health will turn red, but it's not gone. So if you swap them out, they can recharge their health, that portion of the health. Or you can do stuff like sacrifice that portion of their health to, like, go into a kind of super-powered mode. And I guess the thing with that is that works for you if you then pull off some devastating combo that just totally, you know, kills the other person in that span while you are superpowered. So I guess it's a little bit of strategy and stuff sort of beneath the surface, but the veneer of it's kind of fairly accessible and things. And obviously it's based on this anime license, so I don't really know most of the characters on the one side, and quite a lot of the Capcom characters are foreign to me, like people from Onimusha and Rival Schools and stuff like that. I mean,
Is Mega Man?
Yeah, you've got Mega Man from Mega Man Legends, like that kind of look, I think. Okay. Yeah, and you've got Roll from Mega Man.
Oh boy!
When she's defeated, she has the
and the Koban. The Koban is
they're on this like ship at one of the stages, just running around. But when Roll is defeated, she dies in that kind of flash of like circles that Mega Man and all the Robot Masters die in. That's cool. Nice, yeah. But you've also got some stuff from the Clover properties, nicely enough. Like Beautiful Joe is an
Okami?
Beautiful Joe is an unlockable character. And he's pretty much what you'd expect. Like he can do his super moves are like the speed up and slow down powers and things like that. So, you know, it's a kind of nice use of his world, and he looks, you know, exactly the same, which kind of fits in with the whole cell shaded aesthetic, but it's a little different. He's a little sort of unique. And then a little spoiler, although to call it that is a bit rich, considering it's foreshadowed in the intro movie, is that the final boss is actually the final boss from Okami, which is that Yami, sort of like the big orb that transforms into different things.
Huh.
Yeah, that's the final boss, and that's that's pretty cool. It's not nice to see Okami represented elsewhere, and it's kind of your typical kind of last boss kind of thing in terms of, like, it's not necessarily that hard, but it does have certain moves that if you get caught will just pretty much kill you instantly. Yeah, so it's some nice use of the Capcom stuff, and I mean the anime stuff is not that, like, I mean obviously I don't know it, but some of it's kind of charming, and I don't know why there's a giant cigarette lighter robot in the game, but it's kind of cool.
Wait, that's not Heat Man from Mega Man 2?
No, I think it's sort of like Gold Lightan, and he's like a cross between a transformer but a gold cigarette lighter transformer. And like he's
Blunt
one,
Man.
He's my favorite character.
He's one of the two like giant characters. The other one is like a mech thing from Lost Planet, and that's pretty cool as well. Like it's got supers where it has the chainsaw arm thing and just, you know, rakes through you with that. And so there's lots of cool things. It looks good for a Wii game, I'd say. You know, it runs pretty fast, probably not as fast as some of the other Versus games, but it's very smooth. Plays very nicely. Plays pretty well with a classic controller, I'd say. You know, there's no problems. I'm sure people who are like more fighting game, you know, appreciators of arcade sticks and all that might prefer it that way. But obviously, not me, because I haven't played any of those games in a long time.
And did they even attempt online?
No, definitely not. No online. I mean, it sounds like, I don't know, it's kind of strange, really, because it's apparently they shipped it in very limited quantities in Japan. Like something like 30,000 copies or something was the first shipment. Apparently not expecting it to do huge business, so I don't know what the kind of, you know, sort of effort that really went into it was in terms of money. It was developed, you know, to be in the arcades as well, but basically on a Triforce kind of thing, you know, a Wii or a GameCube, you know, in the arcade. So
careful.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same. The point is, it's, you know, the arcade and the console version are precisely the same game. And it's fun. I mean, I quite enjoy just mucking around with it a little bit. I don't know whether I'll ever really sort of tap the more sophisticated elements of it with combos and things, but it is fun. There's not a whole lot of content. I mean, that, you know, obviously compared to something like Smash Brothers, there's not the same depth of unlockables and all that sort of stuff. And it's got like little mini games that use the remote and things, but that's pretty cursory. I'm not sure if any of them really offer anything lasting. But yeah, I mean, the fact that it hasn't got online, I guess, is kind of a limiting factor in terms of, like, you'd have to, you know, in many ways you need to be able to play with someone to get any real lasting appeal out of this game. But we know fighting games online are tough to do. I think Street Fighter H2 HD Remix has sort of nailed it, right? That's kind of the feeling that it is pretty good.
Yeah. I think the new Soul Calibur is kind of widely considered. Soul Calibur 4 was considered to have pretty good online play, but I've heard that the new Street Fighter 2 on XBLA and PSN is like the best ever in terms of online.
I mean, even Ty was saying that he was actually really impressed by it, I think, in one of the threads. Mm. And if he's impressed by it, there you go.
Okie doke. Well, that's going to be the end of new business, I suppose, and we'll take a little break, and we'll come back with DLC Mondays and your listener mail. Okay, we're back with the second part of the show. We'll start with DLC Mondays. And this week we had, I think, a pretty interesting week. We'll start off with Maboshi's Arcade for WiiWare. This is 800 points. It is it's a game out of Japan, actually, and it's published by Nintendo. Although it wasn't developed internally by Nintendo, but obviously they're throwing their muscle behind it a little bit. And I actually downloaded this, and it's a little hard to describe. It's I don't know, have any of you guys played this yet?
It's been out in Europe for some time for some reason, before as well as in Japan, as you said, and it got a lot of favorable reviews. Although, as you kind of said, all the reviews that I said didn't really convey to me what the game is, and I never tried it. But it's supposed to be quite good, so give it a go.
Yeah, there's a lot of like really strange stuff in it.
Right.
So it's basically a collection of three different mini games, and I think each one of them is pretty good. Although I certainly might have a favorite among the three from what I've played so far. But they're very simple. I mean, the two of them you play with only one button. And yet, because they're physics-based, there's actually kind of more to them than you might think based on that description. But there are three mini-games. They really don't have much to do with each other. But while you're playing the game, the game it shows three windows at all times. And say you're playing in the center window, the game will automatically start up games on the left and the right windows. They may be the same minigame that you're playing, they may be different ones, and the game will just autoplay those. So I guess it's sort of supposed to give you the feel that you're like in a real arcade and you're playing a game and other people are playing games on either side of you. But the three windows can interact with each other. Like if you break a block in your window, it might kind of be shot over to another window and break some more blocks over there. Something
blocks.
Like that. So then this other really bizarre thing is that you can save replays of when you're playing the game and play them back later, and instead of having the computer autoplay in one of those windows, you can put one of your replays in one of those windows. So you can basically play along cooperatively with yourself and create interactions between the two that way. It's really strange. You can even send replays to people on your Wii friends list, like your system friends list, and then they can use your replays to sort of play along with you in that same way. I mean, there's not that much interaction between the windows, but there is some, and it does make a difference. And then there's also this really great feature that lets you send a version of the game to your DS. Huh? And it's not a demo, it's basically the full game.
Right,
and you're sending it to your DS, so it's like you pay $8 and you get the game for two different platforms, basically. So the only difference is the DS version doesn't have the three windows. You're just playing on your one screen, but the games themselves are identical. In fact, the level progression, everything is it's exactly the same. So I think that's a fantastic feature.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is very simple, despite the weird bells and whistles. It is very simple for $8, and I kind of think it might be overpriced by a dollar or two, maybe.
I guess the art style of 600, so, that's...
Right.
It's a little in excess of that.
And it's not an art style game,
yeah.
But it's similar in scope, I think.
Sure,
and
that's kind of
what
I tend
to think that it probably should have been maybe in that same pricing scheme as the art style games. But, I mean, it's the kind of thing that I like on WiiWare. It's very arcadey, it's very simple, it's about getting a high score, it's not, it's not a simulation of anything, it is a game, it is a video game, mm-hmm. And it's also unique, it's not like anything you would ever buy on a disc, so, I don't know, I don't regret buying it. I don't know how much more I'm going to play it, but it's definitely interesting. That's probably the best thing I can say about it.
Sure.
And I think it's pretty good, too. Yeah. So the other WiiWare game we have this week is Q-Sports-Pool Revolution. And
another pool game.
Yeah, another pool game. I did my research here. This is from Hudson.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think Carmine played it at a recent press event from Hudson. I think he kind of liked it or, seemed somewhat impressed by it. But It is the second pool game or billiards game for WiiWare. There also there's also at least one on Virtual Console.
Yeah.
And among the two on WiiWare, the other one is called Midnight Pool.
That's the Game Loft one, right?
Right. And this one, the brand new one from Hudson, is only $5, so it's $3 less than Midnight Pool. So if you really want a pool game on WiiWare, I don't know which one's better, but this one's definitely cheaper. So there you go.
I think it's sort of like there's four kinds of billiards games in it or something. There's like, you know, different variations on pool and billiards and things like that. I think that's about the only thing I can remember hearing about it.
There you go. If it has bumper pool, I might actually be down for that. I love bumper pool. So anyway, for Virtual Console this week, we have just one game. It is Zoda's Revenge: Star Tropics 2. For the NES, it's 500 points. Obviously, this is the sequel to Star Tropics, which was released on Virtual Console about a year ago, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys have played this. I did play this back on the NES. It was actually one of the very last NES games ever released.
Yeah, it came out with the NES 2, didn't it?
Maybe. I mean, it came out after the Super Nintendo had been around for a couple years, so it was very late.
It and one other game promoted alongside the NES 2, and I can't remember what that other game is. I only remember this game because I remember its crazy-ass box art.
Wikipedia, fire it up.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, and you know James is.
Yeah, I know.
I am now.
No, maybe not today.
Star Tropics 2, in my opinion, is not as good as the first one. They tried to streamline it. Even if you look at Nintendo's little description of it for Virtual Console, it talks about improved controls. Well, I mean, yes, you can now move diagonally. It's not tile based anymore, so it is a lot smoother. But to me, that's not an improvement, because one of my favorite things about the first Star Tropics is it has this kind of rhythm to it as you go between the tiles, and you know, as you learn the enemy patterns, there's sort of it's almost like fencing. Battling the enemies. There is a very, very strict pace to it, and when you learn that and you pull it off, it's very satisfying, and it makes the game hard. And Star Tropics 2, from what I remember, is definitely easier because they've kind of taken that element out of it, and I just remember it being, you know, really not that great. But I don't know, for 500 points, see for yourself. If you like the first one, go ahead. It is probably a game that most, even Star Tropics fans, probably haven't played. It's pretty obscure by NES standards.
I guess it's notable because it's a Nintendo game being released on Virtual Console. I was looking back at the year for 2008. Obviously, this is the last DLC Monday of 2008 that we're looking at here. And based for the NES, the other Nintendo games out, unless I'm missing one, maybe, but one at most, is Donkey Kong 3, Clue Clue Land, Yoshi's Cookie, and the original Star Tropics. That's it. That's for the NES. And then you have five N64 games and a grand total of one Super Nintendo game by Nintendo, which is Super Mario RPG. That's what they did in a year. So yeah, Tropics 2 is not an inconsiderable proportion of that year.
Yeah, well, one of the things about Star Tropics 2 that makes it noteworthy is that it is the second to last game officially released on the NES.
There you go.
Can you name the last one?
I think it was The Jungle Book.
Wrong.
What?
No. The last one is Wario Woods.
Oh, Wario Woods.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There you go.
But the
there
amazing thing is this game came out like 6 months before Wario's Woods.
It was a long dry spell for NES owners.
Oh, so it's about half that of the N64 dry spell.
Yeah, but you did have all those like unlicensed repurposing of games like into Bible games or whatever to keep me going.
Yes. Oh.
Those were mostly released earlier.
Wisdom
in
Tree.
The lifespan of the NES.
Yeah, the Wisdom Tree games. Good.
Nintendo vs. God, the greatest court case ever.
I don't know. I remember when Left Behind, the PC strategy game, was announced. I was vaguely interested in it because originally it was announced as they were planning to make it M-rated. And I thought, well, now this is pretty curious. A very strictly religious, even evangelical video game that's rated M. Because these are two elements that are usually so opposed to each other. You know, you have like the right-wing religious Jack Thompsons of the world railing against M-rated violent video games, and now you have these guys who are making very much a very hardcore religious evangelical video game, but they're making it rated M. I thought that was fascinating, and unfortunately, they scaled it back to, I think, rated T towards the end. And it turned out to be crap,
yeah,
also,
quite
which
terrible.
that part didn't surprise me. But I was really disappointed that they sort of, you know, they went back on their promise of making it, you know, no holds barred.
You are correct, Johnny. Wisdom Tree is still, for whatever reason, around releasing their releasing their NES games on all-in-one plug-in controllers for the TV.
Oh, sick! Well, you guys know what to get me for Christmas next year.
Well, but if anyone's interested, you can go to their official website, which is WisdomTreeGames.com, and play all their NES games in the VNES Java emulator right on the page.
Wow, there you go. That's kill some time at work. Yeah. So that's DLC Mondays, and now we're going to jump into listener mail. And of course, as always, I want to thank everybody who sent us letters. We had some really good ones this week. And I will go first. This one is from Saturn. Saturn writes, so 1UP's A-minus review on Wii Music is bad because it destroys the credibility of the entire site. If someone buys Wii Music based on that review, and they're like every other person over the age of 4 that doesn't like it, that site is something those people won't go to, will be angry with, and will advise others against. The entire site becomes untrustable. That sucks. Just thought I'd add in my thoughts as to why site-wide thinking is a must, or else the site could die. So this is kind of going back to, I think, a conversation we had a few weeks ago, maybe several weeks ago at this point, because I think Saturn's been catching up a little bit. But it's referring to Jennifer Sal's A-minus review on 1UP of Wii Music, which has been very controversial. We've probably talked about it before. And I think it was one of the last reviews she wrote before she left to go work for another company.
Was it Sega? And, Sega's casual gaming?
Sega casual. Yeah. So, anyway, I don't know much about Jen Sal. I've never met her. But, I mean, I read her review, and certainly she seemed to pick out all of the best aspects of it and kind of ignore a lot of other parts of it, you know, that have been discussed frequently on the show and in many articles. I don't know. To me, I felt like she was being very selective, and that's certainly her prerogative as a reviewer. You know, whatever the parts that she felt most compelling or felt were most important, that's what she wrote about. And I think to the detriment of 1UP's reviews, unfortunately, even their online-only reviews are very short. And it takes a lot of skill to pack a lot of information into a very short article. And sometimes they pull it off and sometimes they don't. But a lot of times I read their reviews and end up feeling like I didn't really learn that much about the game by the end. Or I had major questions that were not only answered but weren't even brought up. You know, they just kind of were ignored. And I don't know, this was a case where I felt like her review of Wii Music kind of didn't really address a lot of questions that I had. It's not like she brought up these things that I thought might be problems and said, you know, actually, that's not a big deal. This is why. It's like she just never got around to it. Maybe she didn't have space. So that's kind of why I felt like her review, I took it with a pound of salt.
Well, what I find interesting about this question is the idea of the whole site wide thinking or imposing some sort of site
standard. Wait here!
Well, so the idea... The idea being, say, for instance, you know, if you were the editor-in-chief at 1UP or whatever, and that review crosses your desk, you know, would you think could you justify it on the backgrounds of what's best for the site to say, no, I'm pulling you off it, someone else is going to write it, or you're going to have to rewrite it because, you know, this is going to hurt us? You know, could you justify that to yourself, Johnny, if you were in that position?
Well, haven't we asked John? He's our reviews editor, for God's sake.
I think Johnny hit the nail on the head when he said that there's, I think with every game there are certain kind of obvious questions that need to be answered. Like I know I was thinking of Johnny's review of Chrono Trigger, and if you were looking to that review to see what Chrono Trigger was about, then his review didn't really answer it. But I felt that because that
it was
game
intentional.
Because that game is so well known that I thought he answered what most people wanted to know, which was would make me buy this again. And I think with Wii Music, I think it's the same kind of thing. I mean, if she wasn't answering the questions that a lot of people had on their minds, then I don't know. I would have probably asked her to just say, hey, there's a couple of things that I think that the general public out there is asking about this game, whether you're hardcore or casual. And I think with a game like that, that kind of was such a kind of like a flashpoint, I think you kind of have to take it from both angles. Like, if you are more into something like Guitar Hero or something like that, will you like this? If you're not, will you like it? I think you kind of have to answer both sides of that question.
The thing is, I mean, in the context of Saturn's question, he's all about that one-ups A-minus on Wii Music apparently destroys the credibility of the entire site. Now, presumably, he is not saying this on the basis that Jennifer Sauer is such a terrible writer or she omitted so many facts. That it is just such a bad piece of writing, a bad piece of prose, that it destroys the credibility of the entire site. It's the perception that the Wii Music is, you know, isn't that good. And so my point is, would you...
I think it's a little different, Greg. I take issue with that a little bit. I think what he's suggesting is that basically his letter presumes that her review is wrong.
Yes,
basically
it does.
That's and because of that, the reason that it destroys the credibility of the website is that the editorial staff, you know, the people who are safeguards against rogue reviewers or whatever, he feels like they failed to do their job. Basically, they should have looked at this review and said, you know what, bitch, you're wrong.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's what I'm saying, though, is that...
I don't want to put that word into his mouth, but, I mean, he's suggesting that somebody should have stopped this from happening.
Yeah, that's my question, is that, you know, if this was someone's, you know, almost abstracting from the issue of how good the review is in terms of serving its functions, you know, providing information, all the rest of it, or the quality of the writing, in terms of just their opinion of the game versus, say, if that particular editor had played it as well, or they knew people that had played it and they all had a different... If it's purely on opinion and it's just different, do you say, no, we can't have that being associated with us, so I'm afraid we're going to have to reassign the review or so? Would you do that? That's my question.
Now, I mean, John will have his own take on this, but I used to be a reviews editor for a long time, and my feel on it is that you have to trust your writers. Mm-hmm. And part of building that trust is you have to ask them a lot of questions. And I used to do this a lot when I edited reviews on a frequent basis. I would ask people, like, how long did you play this? You know, did you try this mode and this mode? I would go read other reviews without telling the reviewer who I was editing. I would go read other reviews, pick up on things that they seemed to really be concerned with, or the things that they were really praising, and say, well, what did you think about these things? You know, I'm not trying to insinuate anything. I'm not trying to put thoughts in their head or lead them towards a certain conclusion. I just want to make sure they were thorough.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure they can present lucid arguments or you know, intelligent criticisms of the things that the average reader is probably going to want to know about. Now, I don't care if the reader disagrees or not, you know.
Yeah.
With a review, you got a certain percentage of readers who haven't played the game and actually have an open mind. You have a certain percentage of users who haven't played the game and have already made up their mind based on other things, and they're just looking for a bone to pick. And then you have people who actually have played the game, and they're basically looking to see if your review backs up their own opinion or not. They're, you know, it leads to flame wars and talkback, etc. But that's all valid. You can read the review for whatever reason you want to.
So the point is, though, therefore, that if someone were be able to present their reasoning adequately, you wouldn't really care if their opinion was different from the mainstream or different from yours. If it's well argued enough, then
absolutely.
Then
if somebody has an opinion that differs from quote unquote the norm, but they can back it up with valid reasoning, I have no problem with that.
So you're saying...
In the context of this, I think it's possible that Jen Sayer was able to actually sort of, if there was a screening process, if you want to call it that, was able to explain her reasoning more fully to her editors than she was in her review, because as you say, it's quite constrained, the amount of text in the one-up. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the thing. When you have the editor asking these questions, you need to make sure the answers become part of the review in some way.
Mm, yeah. But that's the I just think that might be quite difficult in the context of the one-up's online reviews, though. I'm just not sure you could convey all that adequately.
it does raise my suspicion of the website, not because they wouldn't tell her no, but because they have these very, you know, artificial limits that they're not training their writers to work within adequately. Maybe the editors aren't asking these questions that I think a good reviews editor should be asking, especially in a controversial situation like this. And because, you know, when a reader reads a review and still comes out with these questions that weren't even addressed, that's bad. I mean, that means the review didn't do what it's supposed to. And the part of the responsibility is on her, and part of it is on her editors, and that her editors are still there. So that in that way, yes, it does risk their credibility for me. But not because her review is so wrong. It's because of the process and because of the because of what I see through reading this and through this kind of situation, I can kind of see what's going on behind the scenes, and it worries me a little bit.
And then, of course, it should be about the process, because, you know, it doesn't matter to what extent you apply standards and limits and all that. You know, no organization is a monolith. You know, you're always going to have different writers and different opinions, and so it's kind of spurious to infer things about one person from another person's review, but the process is the common factor. So if something's wrong with that, then you can reasonably apply that across the board.
Well, I mean, the one piece of the puzzle that I think is missing here for me is the fact that I don't know what other games she's reviewed. Like, if you look at somebody like, you know, like Matt from IGN, who got a lot of heat from the Nintendo faithful for his somewhat scathing Wii music review. I think he gave it a 7 or something like that.
No, you know, gave it a 5.
Was it lower?
Okay. And the thing is with him, I mean, a lot of people kind of took him to task for that, like, oh, you know, you were just saying this because, you know, you're a Rock Band player, and it wasn't Rock Band, so you killed it and everything like that. But to me, it's like, I can respect that guy's review because I know where he's coming from, because I know what kind of games that guy likes. I know generally his sort of tastes in gaming, so I can kind of frame his review.
You've got context.
You know, exactly, I have context. With her, I don't know what kind of other games she's reviewed. I really don't know anything else. So as far as I know, you know what? She may be something. Maybe she is somebody who is looking at it from a quote-unquote casual gamer's view, who just comes in and says, this is pretty cool, and that's it, and that's all they need. So maybe that's valid.
Yeah, if you think about where she's left for, which we concluded was the Sega's casual game division,
yep.
I think you can say that that's your lens you have to see her looking through.
Yeah, she was at one up for something like 5 or 6 years. I don't think she strictly reviewed Nintendogs during that period.
Yeah.
See, to me, I'd like to get away from this idea that you have to know the person's personality, you have to know their pedigree.
No, I mean, if you have that context, it's one thing.
That
but
stuff can be helpful.
A lot of the time, you're not going
to
have it.
Well, look, yeah, exactly. I think a good example for on our side is if you see that Jeff Shirley had written a review, you know what the fuck you're getting into. You just do. Whereas if you see that, like, Chiron's written a review, Carmine M. Red, you also know what you're getting into.
Well, you do if you go to the site all the time.
Yeah, you don't if you're just picking it off Metacritic on a list, you know, and which is what a lot of people probably do.
But if you saw, I mean, let's be honest. If you saw on Metacritic that we gave We Cheer an 8, that's all you saw.
You've been really eager to get that in, haven't you?
Yeah. Okay, I'm not interested in the Metacritic part. I'm interested in if a person does a Google search
Same
what I'm interested in is if that person reads that review, do they think Carmine is totally out of his mind? Or do they think,
they,
you know,
they might,
he actually kind of backs this up. I think at least he does believe in the score that he gave it. And he gave me some reasons that made me kind of reconsider my preconceptions of this game. To me, that's a successful review.
I would agree.
To me, Jen Sal's Wii Music review doesn't do that, because without the context of knowing who she is, the review feels sort of incomplete. You can't start off a review by saying, well, you know what kind of gamer I am, so let's just jump in.
You have
to be more professional than
you
know?
If you do, though, it helps. I mean, you have
it
to
can
see
help,
that.
But at the end, like I said, it has to stand on its own merits. It really does. And I guess the point I would make here is, to some extent, though, I don't know how much it is that Jen Sao's review specifically hurts 1UP's credibility, as just the short, reduced form format, it hurts it in general. Because I think it'd be naive to think that this is the only game in which there are unanswered questions left in
absolutely. There are tons of them. That's why I don't like their reviews in general. Even the people that I like, you know, I just don't like reading their reviews because I don't think they're very informative. Well, I mean, to a large extent, we kind of danced around the real meat of Saturn's question about site-wide thinking. I mean, obviously, he thinks that's required. He thinks that site-wide thinking is required because otherwise you can't protect the credibility of the group because you might have one individual who's just totally wacko. And again, I guess my point is I would take it away from the people because people are going to have different opinions. I used to tell people all the time, and John, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I would tell people, hey, if the Metacritic average is like a 4 out of 10 and you give it a 9, it is possible that everybody else is wrong and you're the only person who got it right.
Well, yeah. And you better convince
it can go either way, and it really comes down to does your review prove your score, your score, but what you say about it. You have to prove it.
We do have a historical instance of this. Can you think of what it is on our site?
A bunch.
Well, yeah. there's one that we actually got nailed on it from another website, and it's the Mario Tennis for the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, we gave it a 10, right?
Yeah.
It's down. Yeah.
And we actually did catch some flack for that one.
Yeah.
And
I think that Stan's review did a pretty good job of explaining why he loved it so much. I'm not sure that it went the extra mile to really, you know, I mean, when you give something a 10, you really have to be very thorough in justifying that, and I'm not sure that he did that, and that's event, you know, to some extent the responsibility falls on me because I was the guy in charge at the time and I edited that review and I approved it. I did ask him some questions before he posted it, and his answers became part of the review, and it helped. But I probably should have asked more questions.
Just saying that there are examples of, you know, a review hurting, not necessarily hurting a site's credibility, but sometimes bringing questions up about it.
That review probably did hurt our website's credibility.
Yeah,
but
it happens.
But, you know, I never really worried about that because I don't think Stan was wrong on that review. The review probably could have been written a little bit differently, a little bit better, but that comes back to the process, as Greg said. So in terms of site-wide thinking, I don't think everyone should agree on every game. I mean, for one thing, the editor, in many cases, hasn't even played the game that the writer is reviewing. So it doesn't matter whether the editor agrees or not, you know. What matters is that the process works, that everyone agrees on the process and that it's consistent and that it's done professionally.
Right, and that's where we
are. That's what credibility is based on, not scores, really. In my
opinion. Because you're dealing with too many people and too many games for it to be tenable that the editor-in-chief could somehow reasonably project what everybody should think of it and then enforce that as a matter of policy. It's just kind of ludicrous.
Yeah, review this game, but give it a 7.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there probably are publications or websites where that happens, and it's sad.
Call of Duty World at War, 0 out of 10.
Done and done.
Okay.
Run it.
All right. Well, we need to move on to the next letter, and James is supposed to ask that one.
Ask a reader. Or shut up, butcher. Yeah. Let's see. John, James, and Jeg, just to sort of save our J, because he doesn't like the fact that Greg breaks the J theme.
This is from Sam,
by the
way.
I was going to end it with love, Sam.
Why? Now we're just screwed.
Well, that's just dishonest. I mean, he didn't profess any love in the message at all. Why would you do that?
In the letter it says, I was wondering if, with Nintendo's great change of focus in market, you've been tempted to leave the site. You all seem pretty, sorry to use the word, hardcore as gamers. And it just seems that Nintendo isn't. And I bet you're sick of the question. But with the N Revolution magazine actually shutting down because Nintendo shifted focus, I wonder what the people who cover Nintendo as well as N Revolution did think. So basically he wants to know if with Nintendo's shift of focus to casual gaming, if we've sort of become, you know, unhappy and are considering leaving the site. Johnny, I think you should answer this question.
Yeah, it's frightening timing. Actually, just today, sent an email out to the staff telling them that I won't be able to write anymore after the first of the year for the site, and I'm not leaving the podcast. I'm still going to do this, but it has nothing to do with Nintendo. It has everything to do with school and my time commitments. I've got to cut myself off a little more from the website, actually a lot more. I can't be doing these two reviews a week anymore, so I'm not leaving the site. I'm just divesting myself more than I have previously, and that's purely out of necessity. I just can't afford to do it anymore. But it has nothing to do with Nintendo. I mean, I am disappointed in various ways with what Nintendo is doing right now. I'm also very proud of them in a lot of ways. I mean, I think getting John's mother to want a DS is an amazing achievement, and I'm really excited about that. I mean, it doesn't affect me personally that much because I'm not that kind of gamer, but I think it's good for the industry. I think it's good for humanity. You know, I mean, it's putting us all on the same page more. It's uniting us and helping us share common interests more than we were before. And so there's good and there's bad, and in terms of having things to complain about, that's never been a problem in the almost 10 years that I've been covering Nintendo stuff. I mean, there are always people who want more of this, more of that. We want another Mario. Where the crap is our Metroid 64? None of this is new. It takes on different flavors over time, and it ebbs, it waxes and wanes a little bit. But in general, there's always discontent, and there's always something to be happy about. And I think we have, in 2009, a lot of stuff to be happy about. And I think 2008 was a good year. Mm. I mean, I was thinking, listening to the Year in Review episode that we recorded a few weeks ago, and we were talking about sort of, you know, how good the first half of the year was and how bad the second half of the year was. I kept thinking, you know, it's really just the reverse of what it usually is. Mm-hmm. And if you had taken all of the releases in the first half of 2008 and just switched places with the second half of 2008, people would have been really, really happy mm-hmm. with 2008 on Wii and DS, because there were so many good games in the first half. We're not used to having those in the first half, and then there was almost nothing in the second half, and that's when we're accustomed to being flooded with quality titles. And honestly, if you had just flipped the two and made us wait another 6 months for Smash Brothers and Mario Kart and Wii Fit, everybody would have come away from 2008 feeling like, you know what, this was an awesome year. I mean, we had that drought early on, but that's normal.
They probably would have said it's almost the best year ever for Nintendo.
No, yeah,
it probably not as good as the year before, but or maybe 2002, I think, when we had Mario, Metroid, and Zelda, if you count Japan,
all
the same year.
But all the games
in
the DS,
best
though?
Year ever.
Man.
Anyway, I'm just saying, it's all a matter of perception. 2008 wasn't that bad.
No.
We're just complaining about it because recent history has been bad.
I do want to say, first of all, I mean, I do want to say that magazine, which is based in the UK, shutting down, they say that's the reason why they're shutting down. You know, I mean, there's probably...
Suck.
It's just, you know, the fact that print in general is kind of struggling at the moment is probably also a significant player in
yes.
their demise. I mean,
assuredly.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know how much you want to take that on face value.
I doubt they put themselves into unemployment as a means of making a statement.
No, but I'm sure the point is that they may even believe that is some of the cause, but to what extent that's actually founded is another matter. You know, I'm not so sure that they know precisely that they can have. So, and it seems a little facile to just mention that and not mention the difficulties that all print publications are going with to a large extent in general. It just seemed a little reductionist.
You would think that if they are truly a business, why wouldn't they just shift their focus?
Well, I mean,
it's not the easiest thing to do.
It's not the easiest thing to do.
It's like saying,
you know,
why doesn't Goldman Sachs start selling hamburgers?
well, look, but consider the complementarity between the people who are the more traditional gamers and the people that actually use online sources of information. That's pretty heavy. So, in fact, you could argue that the casual focus might be a way to get more people to read, because they're not necessarily people who are going to bother going look at websites about this if you actually shift your focus
as
well.
But then you have to get the casual people to subscribe to a magazine.
Well, maybe it'll have to be a different model, you know, in terms of not so much built off subscribers, but getting people to sort of, you know, just buy it off the shelf every so often or something. But, you know, I mean, my point is, I don't think it's as simple as that. And that's a, you know, it's kind of glossing over it a bit. But, yeah, I mean, I accept the fact that it probably does hurt that, you know, that to some extent, you know, if there's less for traditional gamers who are so into it that they would like to buy, you know, not only will they look online, but they'll buy magazines, they want everything. If there's less for them to get hyped up about, then it could hurt. That's one effect, but among many.
Well, real quick, let's answer the question outright. Have any of us ever considered leaving the site just because we're pissed off at Nintendo?
No.
No, absolutely
no. But I've considered getting fired from the site because I was pissed off at Ubisoft.
That's sort of different now that I think about it.
No, I mean, with me, I mean, you know, I'm probably one of the more vocal proponents of
John Hardcore
consoles. But I mean, when it comes down to it, you know, I just like video gaming in general. I don't harbor any sort of resentment towards Nintendo or hatred towards Nintendo or something. I don't necessarily always agree with what they do, what games they release. But you know, the thing is with Nintendo is that there's always something interesting to talk about. There's always something either going on the Wii that I'm interested in or on the DS that I'm interested in. So, I mean, you know, it's like, okay, you know, if Nintendo releases, you know, Wii Fit 2, I'm not going to quit the site or something like that. it doesn't affect me. I don't take it personally.
I think it's more of a valid question for us than it is in regards to a magazine, because a magazine's a commercial enterprise. With us, we're doing it for the passion of it. And if you lose the passion of it because you're not enthused by the direction Nintendo's taking, then maybe you wouldn't want to do it anymore. In my respect, I mean, I think mainstream gaming passed me by 10 years ago or more. I mean, first-person shooters, all that sort of stuff is never really like that. It's Nintendo stuff that I still like. So it's pretty much impossible for me to sort of lose my passion for Nintendo because I haven't got it for anything else.
I never really considered that at all. There were times when I was afraid, and this does link into the next question, that there were times when I felt like Nintendo was becoming so unpopular, this is before DS and Wii, that we might have to shut down the website just because we wouldn't have enough, you know, we wouldn't have enough readers to support the site anymore. Mm-hmm. Or everyone would just be so apathetic, it wouldn't really matter either way. There were times as a director where I was afraid I wouldn't be able to keep a staff of people covering all this stuff just because there wasn't anything to be happy about in Nintendo land for a couple years. And of course, and I'm exaggerating, there's always something to be happy about. But it was pretty thin. And when you compare that to now, life is good, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. The grass is greener, yada, 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 cliche. But there are always people who are willing to do this for free, and that continues to amaze me year after year.
Yeah.
And very often I wonder why I do it, you know, or why I did it, I guess I should say. But it's because people are fascinated by it. And I think people are fascinated by it in when they think times are good and when they think times are bad. You know, occasionally people become very disillusioned and they kind of lose their interest. And we've seen that occasionally. Some people, I think, more often what happens is people lose their interest in gaming, period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they tend to walk away from things like fan sites. Because they just, you know, real life catches up to them and they just don't care anymore. I mean, in my case, I'm probably as interested or more in gaming as I ever have been. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about it and write about it all the time. It's all I can do right now to make time to play games. All right, so John, you have the next question, and it will complete our trifecta of navel-gazing for this listener mail segment.
Okay, Brandon writes, I wonder if Nintendo's shift to the casual market, and let's be honest, away from the hardcore market, has caused any changes in the traffic received by Nintendo-focused websites. I quit listening to the IGN Nintendo podcast and hardly ever visit their Nintendo site anymore. I still listen to you guys because y'all have personality, IGN was just news, and I don't care about Nintendo news anymore. I don't expect you to divulge private information about the traffic at Nintendo World Report, but I wonder if there are rumblings around the industry about the more hardcore Nintendo sites receiving less traffic now. Gentlemen.
I personally don't know the traffic information.
I could probably find out for you.
We could probably get it, but that's sort of not... Well, Johnny might have handed it when he was site director, but right now...
I used to know.
Stuff.
I think I can probably get away with saying that our traffic has trended downwards over the past 5 years, probably.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's been a slow decline mostly, and there have been plenty of spikes, and there have been good periods where it sort of goes back up for a while. But the overall trend has been downwards, and I think it's from a multitude of reasons. And I've talked with, you know, Steven about this. I've even talked to Billy about it. You know, we were kind of comparing what it was like when he was in charge to when I was in charge. And I tried to never take traffic too seriously because it is so difficult to interpret. It could be because the quality of our writing went down. It could be because our reviews were too slow. It makes you feel good to pin it on those things because those are things you can try to fix. And sometimes when you fix them, it doesn't really help. And you can say, well, maybe that's because people were turned off earlier when these problems did exist. They don't really care that you fixed them. They're already gone. Now you have to get new readers. How do you do that? Yada, yada, yada. I mean, it's you get into circular arguments. Yes, I think Nintendo's shift away from traditional gaming, at least their perceived shift away, it has hurt Nintendo-focused websites to some extent because, as we said earlier, even though Nintendo is more popular than ever, a huge proportion of that popularity comes from people who probably don't go online to look for game reviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't keep up with the latest news.
Yeah.
And so that stuff becomes less of it becomes less effective in drawing people to your website. But at the same time, I think in terms of our particular website, it goes from back in, you know, maybe the early 2000s. At one point, we were the largest independent Nintendo website, as in non-corporate,
yeah,
in the world. We were the largest Nintendo website in the world, not owned by Fox News Corporation or CNET. Okay? So that's an amazing achievement, and you can really only go down from there.
Yes.
And the mm-hmm. reason we went down is because our success fostered a lot of competition, and, you know, over time, other people formed their niches, and then the whole blog scene came up, and now people go online and they get their news or they get their commentary on gaming and everything else in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And we were slow to catch up with that, and even now, we are not a blog. I mean, we have a blog, it's a side project, but we have an editorial process that's totally different from the way a blog functions. We're not Kotaku, and we're not going to become Kotaku.
Thank
and because
God.
Of that, we've lost readers to Kotaku.
Yeah.
We've lost readers to Go Nintendo. There are people who only want what those guys provide, and that's fine.
We've lost readers to Go Nintendo, but they still read our articles.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's on. Frankly, it's very true. So, yeah, we have lost readers over the years, but I don't necessarily think that's due to Nintendo. It probably is partially, and it's probably due to a lot of other things. The management style of the site, the writing style of the site, the whole blog revolution, the evolution of just the way the internet works over the years. I mean, our website is, in March, will be 10 years old.
Yeah.
We are a relic in some ways, and we can try to reinvent ourselves, and some of that may work and some of it may not. But we have been around for so long that in a lot of, you know, if you think about the speed at which things move on the internet, I'm surprised that we're still around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've done a lot to even to just survive this long, and we're going to have to do some more things to keep surviving. But that's, you know, that's competition. That's the way the world works.
Exactly. Well, I mean, one of the things I think the good direction that I like that we're heading in is our Twitter page that Mike put up. Now, whether or not you like Twitter, I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, daily content, that's a pretty cool way to provide daily content.
If there's content,
yeah, and at least it keeps us up to date. At least we're not missing the Twitter boat like we missed the blog boat.
Yeah.
Yep.
The blog boat. The SS blog.
All right, well, I think we need to move on, but it was an interesting question. I hope we gave you a little bit of insight. But certainly, whatever declining traffic we'd had over the years, I don't blame Nintendo for it. Nintendo's going to do what's good for them, not what's good for us, and we just have to adjust and adapt. It's time to move on to our last letter for today, and Greg is going to read that one.
Yeah, well, this is from Blake7584 from Bumpus, Virginia, and he says, where in the heck is Golden Sun 3? I mean, I just played both 1 and 2 in the latter half of 2008 and noticed that the third is yet to come. I mean, how do you make two games and then leave the ending wide open? Get back at me. So I suppose we'll commence that now.
Yes. First off,
so is there some huge cliffhanger at the end of 2? I haven't played either of them, but that would precipitate
this. I only
this
played
response.
The first one, and I infamously hated it.
Yeah, so I'm aware you were not especially fond of it. Anybody else?
Well, that is to say, I gave it a 7, which most people felt was criminal. It's not like I hated it. I just felt it wasn't amazing.
See, you know, if we going back to review topics, if I did a second opinion of that game, I would review it higher than you did. But, mm-hmm. you know, I don't remember there being a cliffhanger, but that doesn't mean there isn't one.
In 2, like...
Yeah,
in
no, two. I know, 2, yeah, because I played it a long time ago. I don't know if it's a cliffhanger or not, but there was a constant stream of rumors they were working on it. Of course, now we know they're working on a golf game, but...
A golf game. Probably several golf games.
Yes, they're working on golf gaming.
There was a lot of talk about some, sort of like MMO golf or something. Like,
yeah.
That's the only thing I've really heard about what Camelot, who developed the Golden Sun games and the Mario Golf, Mario Tennis, things like that, were up to. I really don't know what they're supposed to be up to now. I mean, they did We Love Golf and that pretty much bombed, and that's about that. I mean,
I interviewed the Takahashi brothers, who are the heads of the Camelot studio, years ago at E3. This was back when Mario Power Tennis, I believe, was coming out for GameCube.
So it must be about 2004. Yeah,
it was a while back, and we scored this really cool interview with them. It was one of my favorite interviews ever. They're super nice guys, really animated and interesting to talk to. And that interview is on the website. You can look it up very easily. And if you're interested in Golden Sun, I would recommend that you do so, because we certainly asked them about Golden Sun. There were a couple questions about that. We talked about Golden Sun 3 or some kind of console version of Golden Sun, and they seemed very open to the idea. They were eager to do it. It was a matter of, you know, coming up with the right ideas, coming up with the funding, making sure Nintendo was on board, because they published the first two games, right. And presumably they have some stakes in publishing any further games. Mm-hmm. So, it's not like they said, hell no. They actually sounded really excited about the prospect. Then again, that was years ago. Yeah, where is it now? I don't know. Is it in development now? Mm. I tend to kind of doubt it.
No.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not forget, things have changed in the handheld RPG scene a great deal since the Golden Sun games. You know, some of the sort of attention around Golden Sun, I guess, was just the novelty of having something that was kind of fully fledged RPG on a handheld system like that. And
exactly.
You know, today with what Square Enix is doing on DS and various other development houses and things, it's very competitive. And I don't know whether just trading off the name that a lot of, you know, early adopter GBA people enjoyed is going to cut it commercially. I mean, it may be a very
honestly,
fine bet.
I never really felt that Camelot were particularly good at developing RPGs. I mean, you know, their first RPG was Beyond the Beyond, which is widely considered one of the worst games on PlayStation, one of the worst RPGs of all time. And then, not that many years later, they followed up with Golden Sun, and I kept thinking, why is everyone so excited about this? I mean, don't you guys know any history here? And Golden Sun is certainly leagues beyond the beyond. I mean, it's a much better game, but it's not that great, really, in my opinion. And I didn't play the second one just because I didn't love the first one that much. Steven always told me that it was a big improvement. But, you know, I'm always interested in new RPGs being announced for, you know, Nintendo platform, especially kind of an original IP, not something really lame. But I kind of feel like they're better at making golf games.
Well,
I don't know.
Probably
that's
so.
My opinion.
Well, no, Johnny, they did make RPGs before Beyond the Beyond. They made Shining Force.
Well, that's a strategy game.
Well,
there's
still RPG in it.
Well, the other thing is Camelot themselves. I mean, the Shining Force games were a mixture of, like, Climax, and Camelot was sort of a spin-off of Climax. It was a weird relationship. They all kind of came from Sega originally.
Yeah, they were actually part of Sega, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, to say that Camelot made Shining Force is not really accurate.
Well, they they were credited with Shining Force 3.
Well, you know, I think a lot of Shining Force 3 was done by the Overworks team, who made Skies of Arcadia and just made, well, I'm not sure if Overworks exists under that name, but essentially the same team just made Valkyria Chronicles for PS3. That is an RPG group. Camelot themselves, I do know that they worked on Shining Force 3. Again, that's more of a strategy game than an RPG, in the traditional sense at least. But, yeah. Anyway, they did make Beyond the Beyond, regardless of what else they made, and it is shit. So, I don't trust them to make a great RPG. They're definitely no NX or Level 5, okay? And yeah, obviously they're no longer working exclusively with Nintendo, but that doesn't mean they can't do a project with Nintendo if they want to. They're not owned by anyone else. So I wouldn't rule it out, but I think Golden Sun 3 at this point looks kind of unlikely that it's ever going to happen.
Well, the last game we knew about from them, I Love Golf, which was an online golf game that's going to be on Japan's G Planet system for PC, was in fact canceled. So we really don't know what they're doing.
I thought
right now
that something ill-fated.
So
we don't know what they're doing, basically. Yeah.
We have that they had mentioned that they wanted to work on the Breath of Fire stuff. They had mentioned they wanted to work on...
That would be cool.
They mentioned they wanted to work on Golden Sun 3, and it supposedly was rumored that Nintendo requested they be assigned a Wii remake of Shining Force 3, but Sega never signed on to it.
That would be wild. Because, you know, Shining Force 3 was a three-part game, and only one of them ever came to America on Saturn. The other two were Japan only, so... I don't know. Again, I'm not sure that Shining Force has that much cachet among Wii owners that... But who knows? I don't want to rule it out anyway. Yeah,
well,
it would be cool
the
if
thing
they did.
Is, I mean, I think the biggest obstacle to Golden Sun is that there's no way to really regenerate interest, like, unless they start putting all of those games on the VC.
Which would then come to our long-held rumor that there's going to be a VC for GBA stuff.
Yeah, well, DSiWare, yeah.
Yeah, since they've taken away the GBA slot on the DS.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice, and that would be a good way, as Treasure did with Sin and Punishment, it would be a good way to rejuvenate interest in that series.
Or at least, gauge interest.
Exactly. A couple points of business before we go. First off, thanks for the great letters, you guys who wrote in this week. And for everyone else who's listening, you can send your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We try to read letters every single week, so we need a lot of good ones. Any kind of topics you want us to talk about, any questions, we'll try to get to them. So send those in, and you might be on a future episode. And also, please try to include your location. We like to hear where people are from, like Bumpus, which James didn't even think existed, I think.
No, I've passed it multiple times because I know I do live in Virginia. But, you know, I always just assumed it was a cool joke by VDOT who put an exit sign on there to make immature people laugh as they passed it.
Yeah, there's a place in Colorado called No Name. It's very close to Glenwood Springs, and I've never taken the exit. It could be a joke, but it's apparently a town called No Name. The other point of business I wanted to do before we close up the show is, you know, in doing the Ocarina of Time episode, we got so much great feedback on that from you guys listening. And I think we all felt like it went really well too, except for John, screwed the pooch. But
as usual,
yeah. But we had a lot of fun doing it, and I was talking to the other guys about how it's kind of nice when we're talking about one game that we've all played, and we have more interaction that way, as opposed to something like New Business where we kind of just take turns giving monologues with a couple of interjections or questions from the other people. It's really nice when we all have that common ground, and I was thinking maybe we can turn this into a feature going forward, and this would be similar to, I think, what 1UP FM does with their backlog segment, but different in a couple of ways. I think maybe we could limit it to 1 or 2 weeks instead of going for like a whole month with one game, and that way we don't have to use up quite as much time to do it. And of course it would be limited to Nintendo platforms, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be overlooked games, but maybe just games that you think are interesting. So I want to put the question out to you, the listener. What kinds of games do you think we could go back to, whether, 10 years old, 1 year old, 6 months old, a game that we could reasonably get our hands on and that all the listeners could as well, and everybody sort of play together, and then we can discuss it for a week or two on the show. You guys can discuss it in the forums. We'll read some comments from the forums. We'll have some back and forth. And I think it could generate some really cool radio. But I don't want to dictate what games they are, especially if you guys are going to be playing them along with us. So we're going to create a special thread in the NWR forums. And we'll do a link to it in the article for this episode as well. And I would love for you guys to go there and put up your ideas for games that you would like us all to play together. Maybe tell us a little bit about it, why you think it would be a good choice, and it would be much appreciated if you could kind of include some details on how available the game is, and maybe some, look up some prices on eBay, or is it pretty easy to find in game stores? Is it something you get on Gamefly? Is it on Virtual Console? Something like that. Is it backwards compatible with Wii? Anything like that would be useful to know. And what we'll do is, maybe after a week or two of gathering some suggestions, we will create a poll in the forums and let all you guys go in there and vote on which one you want us to do. And we'll all play a game together. And we're wrestling with the name of this feature, but we're thinking maybe something like Wii Replay. it's better than what Greg suggested, which is Congregame.
That was a facetious suggestion.
Can we just have an untitled podcast segment?
Untitled podcast segment? Nah, we should have a name for it. Anyway, if you have a suggestion for a name as well, you can leave that in the forum thread, and we'll try to come up with something catchy to call it that everybody will like. So anyway, that's kind of our project for the new year, and it's an experiment, but we want to try it out, and we need your help. So jump in the forums and give us your input, and we'll try to do a cool feature. So with that, I think we need to close it out. Thanks to you, to the regular crew for showing up this week, and especially for holding down the fort over the holidays, and Happy New Year to everybody. So I guess with that, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye. It, someone else is going to write it, or you're going to have to rewrite it because, this is going to hurt us. Could you justify that to yourself, Johnny, if you were in that position?
Well, haven't we asked John? He's our reviews editor, for God's sake.
We could do that.
Yeah, F John.
But Johnny was sort of had an opinion.
John, are you awake, John?
Oh, John. Son of a bitch.
John.
Oh dear! Yeah.
Jesus Christ!
Did he just drop off the call without us knowing?
Is this a joke?
He's still there.
I think he went up to make a sandwich.